Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. His latest book, now out in paperback, is Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War. His other books include The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America's Abu Ghraib and the War on Terror. Mark Danner was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, and he's a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books and teaches at the University of California and Bard College. And Mark Danner will be appearing at a benefit for our sister station, KPFA, in the Bay Area this Friday, speaking about the Arab Spring. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thanks, Ian. It's very good to be here.
And in terms of the Arab Spring, there is, of course, spring and winter of their discontent, if you will, in terms of Libya, whereas we had a nonviolent revolution, largely so in Tunisia and in Egypt. This, of course, is the dark side of change. What is your sense of how this might end up? Because it's obviously creating a kind of, in a curious way, creating a rift within the left itself. But we can talk about that in a minute. Just your general impressions of how this...
John, you're asking me to give my impression of how this might end up. I'm reminded of the Yogi Berra line, you know, I never make predictions, especially about the future. And this one is extremely perilous, I think, to try to predict what is going to evolve. It should be said, first of all, that though this is clearly a kind of contiguous phenomenon, one thing is certainly affecting others. You know, the turmoil in one country is, as it were, sweeping across a region, that these are very different events, very different. Things as they are evolving in Egypt, which is a very large country of 80 million, are very, very distinct from what's happening in Libya, which is a much smaller place, though a very large country, a small population, mostly grouped along the coast. And that, of course, has become quite violent. The Western alliance has taken sides, although, in fact, the side that the West has taken, we really don't know very much about. The rebels are not well known. They include some very senior officials in Gaddafi's government, including the interior minister, who only resigned scarcely a month ago. So this is the man in charge of much of the repressive apparatus of the Libyan state, who up until, you know, was a pal of Gaddafi's until about a month ago. And there are other senior officials as well, who've only very recently resigned. So the character of the opposition is difficult to evaluate, and all of this has become, in a sense, packaged as the Arab Spring. And indeed, I think the fact that especially Europeans saw the Libyan events as very much part of a wave of democratic upheaval was what made this intervention particularly popular in Europe. And the Europeans really did lead the way here. The problem is that the democratic content of much of this is certainly uncertain, to coin a phrase. I mean, Libya especially, obviously, we don't know how that will evolve. The rebels, such as they are, seem to be very, very militarily weak. So that's an intervention that... could very well leave Gaddafi in power and leave the Western powers essentially holding the bag and faced with a very difficult decision about whether to up their intervention or, in fact, leave Gaddafi in power and the country, in effect, divided. Egypt, on the other hand, which is probably the most important of these political events, is itself enormously complicated right now. They've had a referendum to change the constitution, which passed by 77%, an open vote, and we can cheer that on. But it also should be said that the democratic activists of Tahrir Square that everyone was so enthusiastic about, in fact, opposed that referendum. So it gives, in a sense, some indication of what the true electoral state of play is in Egypt. That having made a vigorous opposition, traveled around the country and all the rest of it, they got fewer than one in four Egyptians who voted with that democratic opposition. It suggests that still the people who are organized on the ground and who may have a much stronger weight in the elections are the political groupings that already exist, which is the Muslim Brotherhood and the remnants of Mubarak's party, the NDF. So that itself is quite complicated. And then we have Bahrain, which was a movement, a very vivid, strong movement, largely led by, populated by the Shia, who are a majority of the country, even though it's Sunni ruled, that was suppressed fairly brutally with the help of Saudi troops. And now, off on the periphery, a fascinating series of events, you have a rising in Syria, which has become bloody very quickly, and which we have fairly limited information about because Western reporters are simply not let in by the regime. We don't know how that will evolve. And, of course, I haven't mentioned Iran, which is, along with Saudi Arabia and Egypt, is the third great power of the area where you've had a democratic movement that's been brutally suppressed. And we don't know what the future of that regime will be either. So apart from that, Ian, everything is clear.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Mark Denner, author of Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, now out in paperback. But I think you could make the case, surely, Mark Denner, that amongst the people who are propelling these revolutions, whether they're peaceful or bloody, there is a symmetry, I think, throughout the Middle East that young, educated, tech-savvy Arabs are just fed up with having their future stolen either by these potentates, princes, or these colonels, and they're fed up and they're not going to take it anymore. The differences are in the qualities of the dictatorships and the extent to which they're prepared to use naked brutality. And Mubarak backed down, Gaddafi won't back down, the Assads won't back down, and I don't believe the House of Saud. By the way, it's worth pointing out that apparently every day during the Egyptian crisis, the King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, that our sometimes ridiculous press calls a reformer, berated Obama every day saying, give Mubarak permission to start shooting those students in Tahrir Square.
Yes.
That's our friend the Saudi. So isn't that what's really going on here? It's more about the dictators than the people. The people are all the same in these places, as far as I can tell, particularly the young.
Well, I think it's very useful that you brought up that incident with the king, who is indeed our, perhaps along with Mubarak, was our closest ally in the region, and who apparently did not refuse to receive the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, on his last trip last week through the region. He's so peeved at the Obama administration for not sticking by Mubarak, and as you say, urging him to open fire on the demonstrators. But I guess I would perhaps disagree with you slightly. I think that I certainly agree that there's a similar theme running throughout these upheavals. That it's first of all demographic. That is, we're talking about young people who, in many cases, are educated but have very few job prospects. We're talking about societies that, on the whole, are very young, are skewed very much toward youth. For the demographic cohort is very large. That is certainly true. It's also true that technology has helped. But I guess, as my description of what happened in Egypt was meant to suggest, it isn't clear whether, even though if this is the vanguard of these events, whether indeed that will tell when it comes to what indeed the result is. I agree with you that those things are in common, but I don't necessarily agree that those are going to be the political, are going to hold the political weight of what comes after. I think it's up in the air whether that will be what you see as a result in Egypt, for example, whether you see, in fact, the open, democratic, youthful, technocratically directed, modernizing, secular forces that we as Westerners simply want to see. And this comes down not only to those looking at this on their television sets, but also to the reporters, because these are the people the reporters can easily speak to and who are educated like they are, who can speak English and so on. And we almost mask behind this vanguard are much larger societies, much more complicated, and I would argue much less clearly in support of a democratic, in many cases, much more clearly in support of a democratic outcome So I think there are differences. I mean, you say that there are differences in the dictators and how they respond. That's definitely true. And I would add to that that there are differences, obviously, in the U.S. relationships to these dictators, which are absolutely critical. When it comes to Egypt and Saudi Arabia, these have been the closest U.S. Alliances in the region, in the case of Saudi Arabia, for 60 years, in the case of Egypt, for 30. This is absolutely critical, the U.S. interest in these transitions. Of course, Saudi Arabia, there is no transition at present. In other countries like Syria and Libya, in a sense, the interests of the U.S. are, in a way, somewhat simpler. I hesitate to say that since the situation in Libya in particular is so complicated. But these have been regimes that have been traditionally enemies of the United States for a long time, and the U.S. is not ambivalent or ambiguous about wanting them to go. The question is what will follow them.
Well, let me in the last few minutes then just turn to the subject, if I may, Mark Danner, of the split in the left, both in Europe here in the United States, over the intervention in Libya. There's a surreal situation going on now with the Western press holed up in the one hotel in Tripoli where the Gaddafi's people are parading before them these kind of boneheaded European leftists who are ranting at the journalists and talking about imperialist intervention and stuff. And
I saw that in Iraq as well,
yeah,
by the way.
And I recall back at the time of Milosevic, a similar divide. And of course, what Milosevic and Gaddafi have so much in common is they both stole their national treasuries. And in Milosevic's case, he parked it in Cyprus and then emptied the jails, hired all the psychopaths and set them loose on his neighbors. Created the first genocide in Europe since the Nazis, but still a part of the left felt that NATO's involvement there was imperialism. Mm-hmm. So what's your analysis then of this difference between the liberal interventionists and the kind of knee-jerk anti-imperialists?
Well, you know, this is I think you sketched that out very well, and this is a division that we have seen going back 20 years anyway, or longer than that in its roots. We've had a lot of return of the past, the mention of Srebrenica, again and again the discussion of Bosnia, which similarly divided people, not completely the same division, but quite similar. And Samantha Power, who's in the Obama administration, supposedly talked about Srebrenica and urging Obama to back the intervention, which of course had been pushed very hard by the French and by the British and the Italians, most of all. I think, you know, when you look at the divisions here, you're talking about liberal internationalists and idealists, and the idealists, what might be called Wilsonian idealists, really span the middle ground between left and right. I mean, we're talking about, you don't have to go too far to the right when you're talking to a liberal idealist and a Wilsonian who wants to spread democracy or is concerned about humanitarian intervention, which Obama appealed to so strongly in his speech. You don't have to go too far to the right to bump into neoconservatives. I mean, neoconservatives are just... they have very similar sentiments. They don't talk about humanitarianism quite in quite as juicy terms. They talk about the mission of the United States to spread democracy around the globe. I mean, these are words that eventually appeared in the mouth, astonishingly enough, of George W. Bush in his second inaugural.
Well, the fundamental difference between neoconservatives and liberal interventionists is one hates the UN and thinks we should just trample over them to get our way, and the other says, oh, we should use the UN because they're useful.
Absolutely. I think, you know, you put your finger on something, which is the difference isn't what should be done. The difference is the sort of modalities of American power and American power's relationship to multilateral institutions. That's absolutely, absolutely correct. And I think also I agree with that, and I admire the concision with which you stated it. And what I was going to say is that when you look at those who are anti-interventionist, you're talking also about realists again, on both sides of the political spectrum. People who are worried about how this thing could end up, people who worry that we have no exit strategy, quote unquote. I mean, these are terms that go back to at least to the early 80s when you had an argument between George Shultz, then Secretary of State, and Caspar Weinberger. And you have the coining of the Weinberger Doctrine and then the Powell Doctrine, all of which was supposed to restrain U.S. intervention abroad by setting down certain requirements. We need to use overwhelming force. We need to have the support of the American population. We need to have clear goals. We need to have clear national interests. And these restrictions were some of the things that prevented U.S. intervention early on in Bosnia, of course. And one of the distinctive things about this intervention is it breaks almost every one of those rules, almost methodically. In fact, the only one it keeps to is the need to build build international support.
Well, Mark, so, I'm afraid we've run out of time here in Los Angeles, but I'm very grateful for you joining us here today.
Well, it's my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Danner, whose latest book is Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, now out in paperback. He'll also be appearing at a benefit for our sister station, KPFA, in the Bay Area this Friday, speaking about the Arab Spring. Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the end of Wall Street.